I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, calling balls and strikes, that's what Chief Justice John Roberts said during his confirmation hearing for Supreme Court Justice. But critics of the Roberts Court say what he is actually doing is saying that foul balls are home runs. The umpire of the judicial authority in the United States is no longer an independent decision maker about what is constitutional and what role the government should have in our lives. In Lawless, legal scholar and commentator Leah Littman is arguing that the conservative-dominated high bench has abandoned traditional legal reasoning in favor of ideology, emotion, and political grievance. Religious liberty cases, campaign finance, expansion of presidential power, decisions weakening voting rights, they expose how politics of the Supreme Court is being disguised as jurisprudence. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It's inevitable in our form of governance that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to disappoint. Some people are always going to be angry and outraged by the high court when there's a decision that doesn't go their way. Conservatives didn't like the way that Brown v. Board of Education went, or Roe v. Wade, or Hogerfeld v. Hodges in 2015 that legalized marriage equality. So arguing that the Supreme Court is broken because you don't like their rulings, that's just not going to cut it. But if you're able to point out that the Supreme Court is abandoning traditional legal reasoning, coming up with its own flawed facts and running with janky judicial philosophy in order to prop up a political agenda, well, then, America, we got a problem. Leah Littman joins us. Her new book is Lawless, How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. Leah, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hilarious, fun read on the book. Thank you so much for that. But is this just kvetching about a Supreme Court that you don't like, progressives don't like?
I don't think it's just that. And the reason I think that is because in several places in the book, I am able to point to what I think are pretty objective abandonments of traditional law and really inversions of law. So if I could just give one example, when the Supreme Court overruled and invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County versus Holder a little over 10 years ago, John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, had to insert an ellipsis into a sentence in a prior opinion to make the case say the literal opposite of what it said in order to justify the conclusion that the Voting Rights Act was invalid. Basically, John Roberts invoked this doctrine called the equality of the states, supposedly that required Congress to treat all states the same. So he said that doctrine doesn't bar Congress from taking into account later developed evils, and suggested the Voting Rights Act was problematic because it relied on the state's histories of voter discrimination dating back to the 1960s and 70s. The problem is, if you look at the full quote from that opinion, what the Supreme Court had said is that the doctrine of the equality of the states does not apply to laws that were enacted after a state has been admitted to the union. Those are the subsequently developed evils that the court was talking about. So he had to change the meaning of a Supreme Court case and actual law in order to get where he was going to go. And I just think that the modern court has done that so many times in service of their ideology and worldview that I don't think I am just picking a fight with a court whose decisions I fundamentally disagree with.
John Roberts had a history of just not liking the Voting Rights Act. Even when he was a White House aide, he argued against the Voting Rights Act and wanted it taken down, but there wasn't the political atmosphere at the time that would allow that. So do you see he's using his now position, or he did on the court, or he continues to do so, to weaken voting rights?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the more stunning stories, the Republican Party's approach to the Voting Rights Act, because really dating back to Richard Nixon, Republican presidents did not want to adopt, expand, or renew the Voting Rights Act, but they failed to convince the American public. And so Congress repeatedly, and with bipartisan support, renewed the Voting Rights Act and expanded it. So at the same time that that was happening, some Republican presidents basically started to promise that they would appoint justices who would overturn the Voting Rights Act via the courts, where they would be insulated from the people and electoral politics. So Richard Nixon, for example, when he was cultivating support from Southern segregationists, promised to appoint justices who would not, quote, treat the South like a whipping boy on civil rights. And he was referring to the prospect of justices who would, again, overturn, invalidate the Voting Rights Act. And that's what Republican presidents have now been doing for more than four decades at this point. And yes, John Roberts was a lawyer in the Reagan administration's Department of Justice, where he wrote memorandum after memorandum arguing that violations of the Voting Rights Act shouldn't be too easy to prove because they were so intrusive on states' power to run elections. And so it's not that surprising that once he is appointed as a justice of the United States Supreme Court, he would take those same ideas about the law and find them in the Constitution as well.
So it gets to the basic issue in the book that the Supreme Court is able to come up with their own facts to support their legal decisions, their opinions, their vibes, their bad vibes, as you put it in the book. And these are self-sealing truths because that they put out there, what they are not true, but they present them as true, but they're in a position where these facts are unassailable. You can do nothing about the fact that these cases are decided using bad facts.
Yes, no, I think that that's exactly right. And I think the justices have really taken a lot of creative license to the facts in many different cases as they just project their worldview onto reality and the cases that come before them. So just to take an example, at the recent oral argument about whether the Constitution requires states to set up religious public charter schools, Justice Alito repeatedly questioned the lawyer who was arguing against religious public charter schools about whether the state could, has, or would create a school that just taught critical race theory or the 1619 Project. And the lawyer repeatedly expressed with incredulity, no, that wouldn't be allowed, Justice Alito. State law forbids that. And yet Justice Alito and some of the other Republican justices seemed very convinced that schools were teaching woke ideologies and aspects of American history approaches to American history they disagree with. And they used that to understand the constitutional challenge in the case, even though it doesn't reflect reality.
Yeah, we can practically hear them quoting right-wing broadcast media with these views. I mean, I have a very strong feeling what channels their cable box is on.
I think that that's right. And I think you can really hear it in the questions that they ask at oral argument. One of the things I try to do in the book is build in these oral arguments because in some ways that is the moment when the justices are most unfiltered because they are just expressing almost a stream of consciousness of thoughts. And so that's where Justice Alito, for example, invoked this conspiracy theory that various right-wing outlets had peddled, that Joe Biden was secretly releasing money to Iran. Or that's where Neil Gorsuch, for example, invoked a focus on a Democratic representative surreptitiously pulling an alarm bell in Congress in order to disrupt a proceeding. It's where Justice Alito suggested, well, don't the COVID vaccines have these side effects? And you can hear their media ecosystem and the kinds of news they're listening to and the questions they ask during oral argument.
And the news that they consume, we know from their own legal troubles that they say they're entertainment. They're not actually, bound by the truth. And here it is being processed by the High Court. We got to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. You want to talk about the Supreme Court? Do you think that they are lawless or are they out of order? How the Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, fringe theories, and bad vibes. We're going to continue our conversation with Leah Littman when we come back from the break. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this one-minute break.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is Lawless, How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories and Bad Vibes. We're joined by the author, also the co-host of the podcast, Strict Scrutiny, as Leah Littman. You can call in with your questions and comments about the High Court, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Has there been a Supreme Court decision that makes you go, huh, what is that all about? Well, we can talk about that. Give us a call, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Last week, the Supreme Court made a decision in Ames v. Ohio Department of Youth Services. It's been called the reverse discrimination decision, basically saying that members of the majority group are not subject to the highest standard of proof under the Civil Rights Act to say that they have been discriminated against. And this was a unanimous decision. Even the progressives, the so-called progressives on the High Court said this, and it was written by one of them. So what happened there? I mean, if your theories are correct, then why is this unanimous?
So two things I would say to the unanimity. One is that in a lot of ways, this fight over reverse discrimination has already been lost. That is, well before this decision, the Supreme Court had already said when schools or employers use affirmative action programs in order to make their schools or workplaces more diverse and inclusive, that's a kind of discrimination that triggers the same kind of scrutiny as when schools were engaged in segregation or workplaces were engaged in segregation. So in some ways, the big fight in this case had already been fought and lost for progressives. But the second thing I would say is that by joining with the Republican appointees, the Democratic appointees retained the power to write the opinion and shape its reasoning. And if you look at Justice Jackson's majority opinion, Justice Jackson was appointed by President Biden, of course, it differs sharply from the separate opinion that Justice Clarence Thomas offered. In Justice Thomas's separate writing, which reached the same conclusion, namely that these reverse discrimination claims should proceed under the same legal standard, Justice Thomas cited an amicus brief from the America First Legal Foundation, which is an organization Stephen Miller has been associated with, in which he argued that employers today are so obsessed with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, that they are unfairly targeting straight white men in particular. And so by writing the majority opinion, Justice Jackson avoided handing over the pen to someone who would write into the pages of the US reports that the most common victims of discrimination today are straight white men, in which case that would have made it even easier for these reverse discrimination claims to succeed. And so by holding the pen and joining with them, they ward off an opinion that decides more and contains more expansive legal reasoning.
Let's go to a caller. We have Billy on the line, and the number to call in if you want to join in the conversation. We'd love to have you, 833-877-8255. Billy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Right. Well, thank you. I guess my question, and really is more of an observation, is that we see the people on the right finding the Constitution inconvenient ever since the 70s, when you see the change in their approach when they brought in Ronald Reagan. We see their movement is really to reinforce the power of the wealthy and businesses rather than actually serving the their constituents. We see this in data repeatedly where the Congress has shown that they don't respond to the needs of their constituents or respond to how their constituents are, are living their lives and where the policies are adversely affecting them.
All right, Billy, thank you for that call. And so, Leah Littman, that observation may be tied to the fact that the Supreme Court is actually produced, manufactured by the majority, by the minority in the United States. I mean, how does that work?
Yes. So I think what has happened is our democratic institutions have deteriorated in part because of demographic change to a point where it is now possible and indeed happens not infrequently that a president can win the presidency through the Electoral College, even though they lose the popular vote. Similarly, it is possible for a party to obtain a majority of seats in the Senate, even though they represent less than a majority of the country. Additionally, because of gerrymandering, a political party can win the House of Representatives, even though, again, they don't win a majority of the votes. And I think all of those things have contributed to a situation where a party can now win political power and appoint justices, even though they reflect an increasingly narrow segment of the country. And you're right to talk about the specific factor or circumstance of wealth and socioeconomic status, because this was a conscious effort. One of the things I talk about in the book is a memorandum that was commissioned by the Philip Morris Company, tobacco company, in which they asked, you know, how do we fight back against regulations on corporations? And in that memorandum, the author, who was future Justice Lewis Powell, appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, he observed that there's no more forgotten man in American politics than the corporate executive. And so they fixated on finding judicial nominees and using the courts to protect the wealthy minority, the wealthy donors' interests. And that, again, was easier for them to do because it became possible to win political power without winning majority support.
So it helps the argument that there is something severely wrong with this Supreme Court if we can point out inconsistencies in the way that they rule on things that matter apparently to how politics is sliced. And I'm wondering about how the court has dealt with expansions or holds put on presidential power, depending on who is president at that time. During Joe Biden's time, we saw the high court disagreeing with what to do about student loans. During Trump's time, we've seen a big expansion of presidential power from the Supreme Court. And looking at it from your point of view, someone who knows how this stuff works, is that true?
I think that's absolutely true. And I'm so glad you brought up the student debt relief case, because I think that is just a perfect example of the kind of hypocrisy the Republican justices have shown on executive power. Because what the Republican justices said in the case about student debt relief is Joe Biden did not have the authority that Congress gave him to, quote, waive or modify federal regulations. They're the federal government's loans. So the statute authorized Biden through the Secretary of Education to waive or modify existing regulations, including those on student debt. By contrast, the Supreme Court in the last month allowed Donald Trump to violate federal law that prohibited him from firing the heads of multi-member commissions, such as the National Labor Relations Board. And so the court's views of executive power don't allow a Democratic president to exercise the authority given to him by Congress, but do allow a Republican president to act in violation of the restrictions Congress has tried to impose on his authority. There are many other similar examples, but the cases on executive power do indeed show, I think, a fair amount of hypocrisy.
And so does anyone say, hey, Justice Roberts, you know, get a problem here. What happens then?
I'm trying to point it out in the book. I think there is a pretty serious problem in the court's approach to law. I could provide additional examples, but part of what I am trying to do in the book is to give people a broader picture about the court so that they can see the ways in which the court is really gerrymandering the law in favor of Republicans, Republican policies, and Republican political officials. And I think the more people understand about the Supreme Court, the better position we are going to be in to actually develop a court that believes in the law and upholds the law.
Let's go to another caller, Jennifer. And Jennifer, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. I recall when he was running for president that Barack Obama is a constitutional lawyer. What are the chances we could get him on the Supreme Court?
All right. Jennifer, thank you for that. There have been presidents on the Supreme Court before, at least one. I think it would take getting a Democrat in the White House for step one. But Leah, go ahead.
Absolutely. So, yes, Barack Obama was actually the first Black president of the Harvard Law Review. So he graduated from Harvard Law School and, yes, is obviously very familiar with constitutional law. There has been a previous president on the Supreme Court. William Howard Taft, after he was president, became Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And actually, that was the job he really wanted. So when he was president, he schemed to ensure he would get the appointment by appointing someone who was very old to the Supreme Court to try to ensure there would be an opening later on after he was no longer president. But yes, in order to get someone like former President Barack Obama on the Supreme Court, of course, there would have to be a Democrat in the White House and also quite likely a majority of Democratic senators in the Senate as well.
When conservatives see decisions that they don't like, they frequently kvetch about, complain about activist judges, unelected people in robes deciding for the American people, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't cut both ways. We can't talk about activist judges who are on the Supreme Court now who are making conservative decisions.
So we can. I guess I would want to clarify what we mean by activist. Sometimes in the past, people used activists to refer to justices who would strike down federal laws. That's obviously something the Roberts Court has been doing, including with campaign finance regulations or the Voting Rights Act. Sometimes they referred to this as taking decisions away from the people, like recognizing a constitutional right. Well, that's also something the Roberts Court has been doing, particularly with measures such as gun control regulation, finding that the Second Amendment prohibits states as well as the federal government from making various choices about how to regulate firearms. So I do agree that the ways in which Republicans or conservatives previously criticized the court for being activist, that is very much in line with what the modern Roberts Court is doing today as well.
Is the conservative part of the, talking heads world, are they just better armed at dealing with this and that there's still a lot more room for progressives to catch up?
Yes. So I think a big part of the book focuses on the decades-long strategy and investment that the Republican Party and conservative legal movement put into convincing their voters and the base about the importance of the court and learning to talk to people about how and why the court is so important to their lives and the issues they care about. The Democrats and progressives have really not learned how to do something similar. I think there has been progress made. Joe Biden, for example, appointed, I think, the most professionally diverse and demographically diverse set of appointments. They were willing to put in the time and energy to actually focus on judicial appointments, although toward the very end, they kind of gave up and refused to fill some seats on the lower federal courts that they handed over to Republicans. But I do hope and think think that this is an issue where progressives have started to learn something and are trying to focus more on the federal courts.
But it's the long game. It's the long game. But right now, we're going to continue talking about lawless, how the Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, fringe theories, and bad vibes with the author Leah Littman. When we come back, you can call in with your questions and comments about Supreme Court judges and their decisions and how they operate, how they get there. Call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book Lawless, how the Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, fringe theories, and bad vibes. We're joined by the author Leah Littman. She is also the co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny, where they look at the Supreme Court. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So Chief Justice John Roberts is supposed to be very concerned about the reputation of the Supreme Court. He doesn't want people talking about it as a political tool of the billionaires class, the oligarchs. But what is he doing about that?
I don't think he's doing all that much. And I think if you look at the substance of his rulings, he is oftentimes very much with the other Republican appointees on the court. He wrote the majority opinion in the immunity decision that gave Donald Trump sweeping immunity and insulated him from criminal liability for his participation in the Stop the Steal movement and the events of January 6th. He's the author of the opinion in Shelby County versus Holder that invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act. He has authored some of the court's decisions striking down campaign finance regulations. So I think he does desire the court to have at least a superficial appearance of nonpartisanship, but that's not enough to make him change his views. And also, it's not clear exactly what kind of power he has, particularly when we're talking about a court with six Republican justices, because he can join with the Democratic appointees, but sometimes that won't make it so the Democratic appointees have a majority. If you think back to the court's decision overruling Roe versus Wade, for example, he wrote separately to say, I would not overrule Roe in this case. Instead, I would modify the legal standard to allow states to prohibit, at least up to a certain point, some pre-viability abortions, but he couldn't persuade any of his Republican colleagues to join him. So the other five Republican justices voted to overrule Roe versus Wade, and there really wasn't anything the Chief Justice could do about that.
Let's go to David on the phones. And David, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, considering that John Roberts considers himself an institutionalist and you know has written opinions about the independence of the judiciary, why is he not pushing for an enforcement mechanism to maintain that judiciary independence?
All right, David, thank you for that. And what would that look like if someone was to push for some sort of that? Leah?
Well, so we don't really know exactly what John Roberts thinks is necessary to ensure the independence of the judiciary. We do know he has spoken out against calls to impeach federal judges for making rulings that politicians disagree with, for example. And we also know he doesn't care for when Donald Trump, during the first Trump administration, referred to Obama judges and Trump judges. But beyond that, it's not really clear what precisely the Chief Justice thinks is necessary for an independent judiciary. I mean, if you think back to a few years ago, when the reporting about the luxury gifts and largesse some of the Supreme Court justices were receiving was in the news, what the Supreme Court ended up doing was releasing a non-binding ethics guidance document that indicated they would basically try to police themselves more carefully. And so he hasn't really been able to do much by way of substance to shore up the independence of the judiciary, either in reaching rulings that don't split along partisan lines or in trying to make the judiciary and other institutions function in better ways. So he has gotten a reputation as an institutionalist, but I think that reputation oftentimes focuses too much on statements that aren't backed up by action or a small handful of cases that really ignores the bigger picture.
I'd like to get back to this idea that you mentioned earlier that I'm being very oppressed because I'm a straight white male. And so tell me how I'm being so oppressed, because this is news to me.
Well, you know, I wouldn't know from personal experience either. But what the Republican appointees on the Supreme Court seem to think is it was very unfair to, for example, declare a losing side and a winning side when the court recognized a constitutional right to have an abortion. And that seems to suggest it's somehow unfair or illegal to declare a constitutional right that is enjoyed by women and not allow legislators to decide for women when they obtain health care. But the area of law in which this idea of conservative grievance and victimization comes up the most is perhaps LGBT equality. So in that instance, the Republican justices have repeatedly trafficked in this idea that civil rights for the LGBT community, that actually discriminates against religious and social conservatives with objections to civil rights for the LGBT community. So back in Obergefell versus Hodges, the marriage equality decision, when the court struck down laws that prohibited same-sex couples from getting married, Justice Alito wrote in his dissent that that decision facilitates the marginalization of those with traditional views of marriage. He even said it called to mind the harsh treatment of gays and lesbians in the past. You know, in the past, of course, gays and lesbians, they could be institutionalized for engaging in consensual sexual intimacy with a person of the same sex. And Justice Alito is equating that with merely recognizing the right of LGBT individuals to enter into marriages. It's almost as if acknowledging the existence of LGBT people or allowing them to participate equally in society, that he experiences that as an affront to him and others like him because he disagrees with it.
That it would somehow like diminish my marriage to,
right,
to a woman, and because somewhere out there, there are two consenting adults of the same sex who are also married. I don't see, you know, do they have to support that with facts? How do they get there?
They usually get there just by fiat.
So those
just
are the vibes.
Exactly. That's the vibe. And vibes are going to carry the day over facts and reality. So Justice Alito has repeatedly insisted that you can't say anymore that marriage is between a man and a woman. You can say that, of course. He says it all the time. What he means is you're criticized for saying that. And because I guess he perceives that criticism as such an affront and such an attack, that is the view he has written into the law as well.
People who are Christian, do they have more rights than anyone else in this modern Supreme Court?
So the court is definitely most solicitous of their rights. You know, just to take an example, I mean, the court, what we were just talking about, has identified civil rights protections for the LGBT community as unconstitutional discrimination against conservative Christians with traditional views about marriage. But if you think back to the first Trump administration, after Donald Trump promised a complete and total shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, the Supreme Court upheld his travel ban, which restricted entry from several majority Muslim countries. And so the court is not uniformly attentive to claims of religious discrimination. It's just very, very fixated on this idea that, of course, religious and social conservatives, they're the true victims today.
In the Dobbs v. Jackson decision, the write-up was very much, there was a lot of history there, but nothing that an actual historian would recognize in regards to, you know, the history of abortion and regulation of abortion and how attitudes have changed about that over the eons. I don't know. So, I mean, but there's no historian actually involved in writing these things. It seems like, again, it's just kind of like, well, I saw a movie one time and there was this stuff in there. And so let me put this in this opinion and it sounds good and it gets me to where I want to go, but there's no fact check on these things.
Oh, definitely no fact check. And even when it is brought to their attention that the facts
are not as they... didn't happen, okay? I don't know where you...
they just don't seem to mind. Well, so to take an example, I mean, Justice Gorsuch wrote in this opinion that we are dealing with a case where a football coach just engaged in private prayer that was totally removed from his responsibilities as a coach and a school teacher.
But it was in the end zone.
Right. Justice Sotomayor includes an actual photograph. He's in the end zone, surrounded by players. That's not a purely private prayer.
And we have testimony from players saying that they were pressured into participating.
Exactly.
So it's not about the facts. It's about whose facts matter.
It's about the vibes.
It's about the vibes. And so, but I got to take a break here. But when we come back, we're going to figure out where is this taking us? If we have abandonment of the Supreme Court is no longer the umpire who is calling balls and strikes based upon our agreed upon constitution and these principles and accepted legal theory, and instead it's just a bunch of yahoos who are just working off, their feelings. Where does that take us, and how do we get back, and how do we have a functioning society and government based on that? So we do want to hear from our callers. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll continue discussing Lawless, how the Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, fringe theories, and bad vibes with the author Leah Littman. When we come back, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Leah Littman's with us. You may have heard her. She's a co-host of the hilarious podcast Strict Scrutiny, where she does talk about the Supreme Court and the law. And you can join us as we talk about her book, Lawless, How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. The book is filled with a lot of pop cultural reference, reality shows, and White Lotus, and Arrested Development, a lot of references in there. Some of them I had to look up because I'm not that up to date on pop culture. But Leah, so thank you for writing a hilarious book as we talk about something that is not funny at all. So I want to get to states' rights. This seems to be the pain point of a lot of these discussions where a lot of the Supreme Court talks, in the past, they say, well, we have to defend states' rights. And the argument is, we want states' rights, we want the right, but then eventually they give away the game, and it's not about states' rights. It's about bigotry, it's about discrimination, and it's about power. But, how does an argument like that still have currency when we actually know that it no longer is the central issue?
I mean, it gives them currency because it is a superficially neutral way to describe what they are doing without having to say, we are giving people a right to discriminate. We are giving states permission to deny women life-saving, health-saving care so that they can be forced to beg for their lives in order to receive the emergency treatment they need. And
right, so to the point, though, they argued that, in the Dobbs, that this is the states' rights, to kick it back to the states, but now we're hearing, well, we need a national ban on things like medical abortion and things like that. So that's given up the game. So, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when they said we're returning this to the states and Dobbs, what they really meant is we're allowing any politician at any level to do what they can on abortion.
Okay. So states' rights, I mean, even, Barry Goldwater would argue he was in favor of civil rights, but he wants it done at the state level. But we know that states are not capable of putting together a comprehensive and enforceable civil rights agenda because the bigots tend to get elected at the local level. So, and we want to have a nation bound by similar ideas and ideals and principles and laws. So that's the central conflict between having a union of states, and the nation is based on that union of states, but also having a national legal framework.
Yes. And if you think about it, you can also think about it in terms of what rights are so fundamental to us as a country that we wouldn't allow them to vary state by state. I mean, no one should say, well, states' rights, so therefore it doesn't matter whether one state has segregated public schools because states just get to decide that. So why are we now saying, well, states get to decide whether women get health care, whether trans people get health care, whether LGBT individuals can be discriminated against? Those are the sort of rights that should define us as a country and apply nationwide.
Let's go to another caller, Randall. Randall, you're on the air.
Hey,
go ahead.
Good afternoon. Well, I'll talk about both of these. I've got a couple things here, but, you know, this idea you're talking about abortion rights, and we're talking also about gay marriage rights. If you go into the Bible, both, I think, in the Old Testament, both abortion and homosexuality are addressed in the Bible. And the reason I bring that up is these things have been with us 4,000, 5,000 years. They ain't going away anytime soon. So I might as well learn to live and let live, right? As far as what we can do from here on out, is it maybe time for term limits? Maybe somehow staggering the justices. You get a 20-year term, and these things are staggered 4 years apart, so that in a perfect world, the president has no more than, say, one SCOTUS appointment per term. Now, of course, things like illness and death are always going to come in and kind of interfere with that. But, you know, at least when we start out, you know, you more or less get one term or one SCOTUS appointment per presidential term. I mean, is that possible? And I realize it takes a constitutional amendment.
All right. So, Randall, thank you for the call. Been a lot of calls for doing some sort of reforms to the Supreme Court. And so Leah Littman, it doesn't look like that's going to happen under the current administration.
No, it doesn't. I do, however, think term limits are a great common sense solution to regularize Supreme Court appointments, but they're also not going to change the court we have now, because you certainly could not apply term limits to justices who have already been appointed. So term limits are not going to change the Roberts Court. They could have some effect, you know, 30, 50 years from now.
Well, the oldest person on the Supreme Court right now is Clarence Thomas, 75 years old. There's been talk about him voluntarily stepping down so that Trump can appoint a younger person to that seat. But he has expressed this. It's been reported that he doesn't want to be replaced by a hack. Okay. Leah Littman, go.
Well, if Clarence Thomas doesn't think he's a hack, that should give you some sense about possible replacements for him. I think one of the most likely replacements is a judge on the Fifth Circuit, Jim Ho, based in Texas, who has argued that in the Alien Enemies Act litigation about men being sent to the El Salvador prison, he wrote separately to explain that certain people were being treated very, very unfairly there. Those people were Donald Trump and other federal officials. So that's a possible replacement.
So we had that earlier caller speculating about why not Barack Obama on the Supreme Court. And I'm thinking, you know, it's far more likely that Ted Cruz would end up on the Supreme Court. Thoughts?
I think that's pretty unlikely. I have no doubt that Ted Cruz's Senate colleagues probably want to get rid of him. Still, I don't see them putting him on the Supreme Court.
All right. Well, he sees himself as a constitutional scholar and someone who would be great for that. If people just gave up the ghost on the Supreme Court and just recognize it is full of political hacks, and this is not where we call balls and strikes. This is how fringe and political agendas are put into law and propped up through just they don't care about the facts. It's just this is the way it is. What happens when that becomes broadly accepted as fact?
I think in that world, what we would probably want to do is to shift more decisions to be made by our elected representatives in Congress. You know, if we think the justices are just deciding these questions based on their background, ideology, and political affiliation, then better to have the decisions made by people who would be acting on their ideology and political affiliations that we can actually vote out of office.
Yeah, and so the thing I'm trying to get to is we have a government that really depends upon people believing in it in order for it to work. Now, as we know, the Supreme Court really has no enforcement mechanism. We see that Donald Trump has been flirting with the idea of ignoring the Supreme Court decisions if he's not going to like them, although that has not happened yet, but he's talked about that. What if it all falls apart? What if he says, this is your decision, you go enforce it, otherwise I'm going to continue to send people to the El Salvadorian gulag?
I think people are rightly concerned about that. However, I do think the courts actually have a lot of power to enforce their decisions. One thing they can do is begin criminal contempt proceedings. Even if the federal executive branch is unwilling to begin prosecutions, courts can actually appoint outside prosecutors to do so. And then they can also call upon the United States Marshals, either to help them assist with criminal contempt or civil contempt. And the idea that the president would just say, well, I'm not going to enforce that decision, and therefore it wouldn't be enforced, kind of depends on the assumption that all of the United States Marshals would take the president's illegal orders and directions. And at least I personally have more faith in federal workers than that.
Which is the Supreme Court case that really leaps out at you that really illustrates how, when you say this Supreme Court runs on conservative grievance, fringe theories, and bad vibes, what is the one case that we should be looking at to say, oh, yeah, I see it now?
Just one? If I had to do just one, I would
say creative, maybe? I don't know.
303 Creative versus Alenis, exactly, where they said the wedding website designer didn't have to make websites celebrating same-sex weddings, even though she had never been asked to make one. And even though they insisted that refusing to make a wedding website for a same-sex wedding was somehow not discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. That opinion is pretty wild.
Yeah, it's based there is no harm was ever done to anyone.
Right, exactly. I mean, the case was really created to allow the justices to create some sort of First Amendment exception.
Is that why they call it creative? Is that why
it's exactly. little double entendre there.
Yeah, so it's a sort of self-reinforcing the fact that this was a decision where no one actually was harmed in the like the horses in the movies. No actual citizens were harmed in the making of this Supreme Court decision, although people, how are they going to be harmed in the decision that was made?
So how are they going to be harmed? I mean, what the court has basically done is almost create open season where many different people are now arguing they have the constitutional right to discriminate against same-sex couples. So it's not just wedding website designers, it's hairdressers, it's employers. It is, you name it. And so the court is creating the situation where they are reopening the door to more discrimination against the LGBT community.
So you have your podcast, Strict Scrutiny. There are other podcasts out there as well who are looking at the Supreme Court and they're giving them scrutiny, looking at what they're doing. It does seem like there is a way for people to become better armed in thinking about this. You just can't rely on some of the mainstream providers of news, that they're just not going to bring you the information that you need in order to have an understanding of what is happening to our country. I mean, is that what you're doing there in your podcast?
We are certainly trying to give people a deeper picture about what is happening at the Supreme Court. I mean, it's hard to cover the importance of a Supreme Court opinion in just the short amount of time or words a lot of media have. And we try to provide more background context to show how the law has changed and also how it is drawing from surrounding political movements and social movements as well.
All right, Aaliyah Littman, thank you so much. Her book is Lawless, How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. It was great talking.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's The Source from Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening. ¶¶
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.